From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this one-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, we talk with a disaster science specialist who has spent the past year investigating what went wrong and considering how to prevent a future hurricane catastrophe in New Orleans. Ivor Van Heerden is deputy director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center and a member of Team Louisiana, which is investigating the levee failures. Also, we talk with Father Doug Dusan and Sister Kathleen Pittman about rebuilding their church in New Orleans and helping people in their parish find the resources to rebuild their homes. But the church is still surrounded by destroyed homes, and Father Doug and Sister Kathleen are filled with doubt and hope. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Ivar van Heerden, has spent much of the past year looking into what went wrong during Hurricane Katrina from his perspective as a disaster science specialist and hurricane researcher. So on this one-year anniversary, we invited him to talk with us. Van Heerden is the deputy director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. He's one of the leaders of Team Louisiana, a group of six LSU professors and three independent engineers investigating the levee failure for the state's Department of Transportation and Development. And he's the director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes. Van Heerden has written a book about Katrina called The Storm. Ivar van Heerden, welcome to Fresh Air. After preparing for a hurricane for so long and creating models to forecast the consequences of a hurricane, what was it like a year ago to actually live through that hurricane?
You know, it really dawned on us on the Saturday night with landfall being on Monday when our first model runs showed that the city would flood. And I remember going to one of the fellows I work with, Mark Levitan, and saying, my golly, this is it. This is the big one. And, you know, feeling an absolute chill and dread because we knew then that within 48 hours there would be a fairly significant loss of life and a lot of damage.
What are the ways that you feel your models were used by firefighters or the police or you know, the mayor, the FEMA, whoever, to help figure out what was going to happen and what could be done about it?
Well, we're not sure what the mayor's office did with the data or FEMA, but we know that the fire chiefs in New Orleans got color printouts of the storm surge maps, placed them in Ziploc bags, gave them to their crews and said, okay, this area, this neighborhood is going to flood based on Ivar's model. We need to go there now before the storm arrives. And anybody who hasn't evacuated, we need to move them out of those areas so that they won't be flooded, so that we won't have to come in and rescue them later. So they, in essence, started the rescue early and moved a large number of people out of harm's way. And those same fire chiefs told us that the model did an excellent job right up until the levees failed. And then, obviously, the model results no longer held.
You know, during this anniversary week of the hurricane, we're hearing a lot about people who have moved back to New Orleans and who are starting to rebuild. Do you think that New Orleans is prepared enough for another hurricane to justify the rebuilding that's underway now?
Well, that's a tough question. New Orleans isn't any safer now than it was before Katrina. The repairs have been robust, but there are some areas that don't look very good in terms of repair. We're hoping that some of the new untested technology the Corps has brought in with floodgates at some of the canals would work. But for the longer term, we have to recognize that Katrina was a fast-moving Category 3 storm that actually missed New Orleans. If we had a Category 3 storm that moved a little slower than Katrina, but it passed west of the city, we could fill up every single part of New Orleans without a levee even having to fail. And that's part of the city south of the river that we call the West Bank. So we're a long way away from having the real security that we would like.
In the scenario you just described, the water would overtop the levees?
It would overtop the levees from Lake Pontchartrain in the north and from the Barataria Bay south of the West Bank.
So are you saying you think the rebuilding is premature or that things just have to hurry up with the rebuilding of the levees?
Well, I think that the rebuilding has to go on because we have to get New Orleans back on its feet. It's in a very important part of the local economy as well as the U.S. economy. But in parallel with that, we could now be starting with the large-scale coastal restoration projects that are needed. We could be starting with some of the major barriers and floodgates and levees. offshore of coastal Louisiana, just to give you an example, we have excellent sand resources in federal waters that we could mine and use that sand to rebuild the barrier islands. They're our outer line of defense. That's a project that could have been started right after Katrina.
Would you describe why the barrier islands are an important line of defense?
Well, they have two important functions. The first one is they trip up the waves. So in other words, in the Gulf of Mexico, in the case of Katrina, we had 30-foot waves. They were rushing towards the shore. Once they hit the barrier islands, they were knocked down to about 7 feet in height. So they lost a lot of the energy. So as a result, they're not that erosive on the coastal wetlands and any of the levee systems they may hit. And additionally, they can also slow down the surge. Anything that adds friction to the system that can reduce the surge is beneficial. So the barrier islands play a very important role, obviously the wetlands as well.
So why have the barrier islands eroded or diminished, or whatever the right word is, to the fact that they're not as robust as they used to be?
Well, a couple of things have gone on. One is they've been starved of the sediment that they need, and some of that reflects natural processes. Some of that reflects the way we manage the Mississippi and Atchafalaya rivers. But more importantly, the barrier islands are being crisscrossed with different canals, navigation canals, pipeline canals, and so on. And this has disrupted the local hydrology, the local patterns of sand movement. So as a result, they've shrunk down to probably 15% of what they were 100 years ago.
And you're saying we could build them back up again?
Definitely. We have these sand resources offshore. A number of years ago, I was involved in the mining of marine diamonds in southern Africa, where we would move gravel off the seafloor from a depth of 150 feet and actually pump it onto the shoreline a number of kilometers behind us. When it comes to the case of the sand off coastal Louisiana, it's excellent sand. It'd be very easy to mine. It's only 11 miles, and there's over 13 billion cubic yards of it. So we don't need that much. We don't even need a tenth of it, and we could have some of the most robust barrier islands in the world.
And why are wetlands important when it comes to controlling the impact of hurricanes?
Well, the wetlands have two very important functions. You imagine a hurricane approaching the shoreline. On the right-hand side, the winds are blowing towards the land and it's blowing the surge forward. But on the left-hand side, the winds are blowing offshore. So the water in the wetlands and the bays is dropping as it's moved out to sea. And as a result, any feature out there, so imagine bushes, trees, grasses, especially our cypress swamps, sticks up into the wind and it adds a lot of friction. So it helps reduce the wind energy. In addition, we go back to the right-hand side. As those waters are blown ashore, they start to feel the impact of the ridges, the little levee systems that exist throughout coastal Louisiana, the natural levees, as well as the wetlands, and especially where we have the cypress swamps. We now know from research we've just conducted is that a healthy wetland reduces the surge by 1 foot for about every 3 to 4 miles of wetlands. Recognize that New Orleans has lost about 15 miles of linearly of its coastal wetlands. So if we had those wetlands now and if they were in healthy condition, we potentially could have reduced Katrina's surge by about 5 feet.
Why has New Orleans lost so much of its wetlands?
The biggest reason for the loss of our wetlands was the levying of the Mississippi River following the 1927 flood. Prior to that, when the river flooded, the sediments and the nutrients would flow out over the wetlands. We came along, we levied the system, we basically made the river a canal, and now all that richness and goodness goes offshore. So what I tell my students is imagine if I put an elastic band around my hand, eventually my hand would die because I've cut off that delivery system. And that's what we've done. We've basically starved our wetlands to death. And in the case of New Orleans, we've lost probably more than 500,000 acres of wetlands.
And I think that the canals have allowed salt water into the wetlands. How does that happen, and why is that bad?
Well, we've cut off the sediment supply from the Mississippi River, and then we've exacerbated the problem by dredging a lot of navigation canals, oil and gas pipeline canals, as we've mined the richness of the oil fields in coastal Louisiana. The net result is we now have shortcuts from the Gulf of Mexico into some of the freshwater environments. Salt water moves up these canals, the plants can't handle it, and they die. So the disruption in the natural hydrology because of these navigation and pipeline and other oil and gas activity canals has had a very dramatic impact on the wetland loss. Recognizing that this is a system that's starved, and now you come and disrupt its natural delivery systems.
My guest is Ivor Van Heerden, Deputy Director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center and author of the book The Storm. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ivor Van Heerden, Deputy Director of the LSU Hurricane Center and Director of the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes. Now, you had predicted catastrophe if there was a big hurricane. You predicted this in a 2005 study. So now that some of your predictions came true, do you feel like your predictions about what could happen now are being taken seriously?
Certainly at the state level and at the level of local government, the science is being used far more. I think everybody recognizes that, unfortunately, we had it right, and that we do have, you know, these tools that we can utilize. One of the things that we did do through our public health center was do extensive public opinion surveys. So as a result, we knew how many people would evacuate, how many people would stay behind, the basic demographics of those who would stay. We had an idea of how many would be homeless, how many would be disabled, and so on. So that public opinion data allowed us to really advise the first responders where to be looking first in terms of those who would be most likely to have the least resources, so the areas where the poorer people lived or where there were high concentrations of retirees.
You have computer models that can predict how a hurricane might behave and how that might affect New Orleans, but you don't have a computer model that can predict how you will behave in the face of that kind of disaster. Did anything surprise you about how you behaved a year ago?
I think that the thing that surprised me about myself was somewhere I found an inner strength to be able to get out in front of the national media and international media and say what needed to be said in terms of not only the science of what could go wrong, but when we saw the failed recovery efforts, that we could then start talking more strongly about what was needed and the net result of the lack of response. So, you know, there were some really tough times because as an academic, you were, in essence, having to make political statements, and that's not very popular, certainly in Louisiana institutions. And I definitely had to take a couple of breaths and just say, well, this is it. I'm going to have to say what has to be said.
Was there a part of you that wanted to go into New Orleans during the hurricane and actually experience what you could of it, either during or right after, because it's something you had thought about for so long and planned for so long?
Yes, I was torn between getting in my four-wheel drive and driving right down into New Orleans, and obviously the safety of my family. We live out in the country in an area with a lot of trees, and I knew we'd have trees come down. So I waited at LSU till the last moment, drove through some of the storm, and then went home. Obviously, after we knew that the city was flooded, we wanted to get down there as quickly as possible. And my first trip was actually by boat. I crossed Lake Pontchartrain and went into the city that way.
And could you talk a little bit about how the reality of the flood compared with what you'd always pictured from your computer models?
There's absolutely no way that the computer models could prepare you for what you saw when you actually got down on the ground. You know, it's one thing to see these computer animations of different colors filling up a city and flooding neighborhood by neighborhood. But when you get down there on the ground and you see mile after mile after mile of these flooded homes, just the roofs visible in some places in New Orleans East, the roofs were below water, so you knew in those areas anybody who had stayed wouldn't have survived. It's an unbelievable experience. Your heart is just feels like somebody's clutching your heart as you fly around or move around. And then I think that was followed by determination from all of us in the Hurricane Center to really try and understand as much as possible about what went wrong and why and what we can learn from this. And then that precipitated the study into why the levees failed.
Everybody wants to be right. You were right, and that meant catastrophe. You were right in predicting what would happen if there was a hurricane, a big hurricane in New Orleans. I'm sure it's something you kind of wish you weren't right about. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of mixture of emotions you had, knowing that on the one hand, you were vindicated, you were right. On the other hand, it was a catastrophe.
Well, there's absolutely no joy in being right. You know, there's been a lot of media coverage, and I found my ugly mug on TV all over the world. And it would be much nicer if that was happening because I'd, you know, found the cure for cancer or something. So there's no fun in being right. But I think it's very important to tell the story of Katrina, the good sides and the bad sides, and to ensure that something like this never happens again. And part of that was to write the book and try and express what I saw and what I understood, and with the hope that this never ever happens again.
Your book that you just referred to is called The Storm. Do you see any opportunities now in New Orleans, since so much was destroyed and has to be reconceptualized and rebuilt? Are there opportunities, ones that you haven't yet mentioned, that the city should take advantage of?
Yes, I think, you know, some of the subdivisions that got destroyed are very low-lying. And certainly if the homes had been elevated, then they would have been able to have, in essence, absorbed some water. So I think we have to recognize that what we had in the past didn't work, whether it was coastal restoration levees or how we built our infrastructure in New Orleans. And we're going to, as we move forward, as we plan for the future, it's not only the wetlands, it's not only the levees. We have to build our city smarter. Some of that is going to be raising the houses. Some of that is going to be abandoning areas that are low-lying, perhaps creating parks or ponds. And we're going to have to get a lot smarter in terms of the infrastructure. We had major problems with power lines and the sewerage systems and so on. And one thing we could learn is, let's bury our power lines. If we had our, as they do in many European countries, once those power lines are buried, we don't have to worry about them coming down. So, if you will, nature has given us a chance to plan a 21st century city in a location that has, if you will, severe drawbacks in that it could be sunk again if we have another major hurricane.
Are you optimistic that New Orleans will emerge as this model 21st century city, or do you think things will be done too piecemeal for that to happen?
Unfortunately, right now, I'm not very optimistic. The political will is not there. There's no consensus. We have different groups competing with each other as to who is going to actually draw up the plan, who has the say. Unfortunately, race is a part of the problem. One keeps hearing that we can't rebuild the lower Ninth Ward because it's the lowest lying land. And in fact, it isn't. It's some of the best land to be rebuilding because it's close to the Mississippi River and it's higher. So at this point in time, we may have to actually wait until we get through the next election cycle before we can get a unified voice out there in terms of how we're going to restore and rebuild New Orleans.
You're saying that that neighborhood isn't being rebuilt because of race?
Well, there are a lot of entities and a lot of groups are saying we shouldn't rebuild the lower Ninth Ward. And my own personal feeling is that that race has a lot to do with it.
It was primarily African-American and I believe a poor neighborhood?
It was a poor African-American neighborhood, but a neighborhood with an enormous amount of culture.
Ivor Van Heerden is the deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center and author of the book The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with Father Doug Dusson and Sister Kathleen Pittman about rebuilding their church in New Orleans and bringing it back to life. And we continue our interview with disaster scientist and hurricane expert Ivor Van Heerden. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to our interview with Ivor Van Heerden, Deputy Director of the Louisiana State University Hurricane Center. He directs the Center for the Study of Public Health Impacts of Hurricanes at LSU, which had started studying the potential effects of hurricanes on the population of New Orleans several years before Katrina hit. So are you still doing this study? Is this an ongoing study?
Yes, it's It's not every day you start a study and then end up with the lab in your back door, so to speak. We are continuing. Unfortunately, our funding runs out fairly soon, so we are in the process of getting additional funding. But the study's continuing, and We were very fortunate in that the funding agency right after Katrina gave me permission to use our research dollars for operational support. So, for instance, we had people in New Orleans sampling the water for chemical and bacterial contamination within 5 days. And in this way, we're able to give the various medical response crews some idea of what they were looking at. The mapping, the geographical information system, the GIS mapping, we, as I mentioned earlier, we moved that into the State Emergency Operations Center and started mapping for them any bit of information. One of the first things they wanted to know was, where are all the nursing homes? In addition, we could take that database and plot all the 911 calls, and our record was 79 people saved one day out of their attics. These are folk who could not break through their attics, had taken refuge in their attics, and may have well have died there if we hadn't been able to determine from their cell phone calls where they were located.
What role did your center play in determining where they were located?
Well, the signals were very weak, and a lot of it was text messages, and they, so we weren't often getting addresses, but we could, from the GPS, the global positioning component of the cell phones, we could start trying to plot where these groups of calls were coming from, and then first responders could go by boat from house to house to house, knock on the roof in the general area where those calls were coming from until they heard a response, and then break open the roof and get the folk out.
As someone who has studied the public health impact of hurricanes, are you relieved that there was no major epidemic after Katrina? Did you expect that would be one of the consequences?
Yes, we are very relieved. That was one of our concerns, especially when the response was to move people from New Orleans across the United States. One big scare was there were about 11 or 17 residents of New Orleans who had a drug-resistant form of TB, and they were lost for about 2 weeks. In addition, New Orleans is a port city, so every day we get sailors in and sailors out, a lot of them from tropical parts of the world, and so there's always a resident pool of diseases like dengue and malaria. We obviously have a real mosquito problem, so the concern is that we would spread some of these diseases through the country. I think the Centers of Disease Control were very, very worried, as were others, when we started to just literally ship New Orleanians all over the country without any medical surveillance beforehand.
I believe one of your passions is sailing, is that right?
Yes, very much so.
After the hurricane, did it take a while to develop a passion for water again, an interest in being in the water?
Well, to be quite honest, in the last year I've sailed my sailboat 3 times. There's been an enormous amount of work, and in some ways, it just didn't feel right to go out there frolicking and sailing while there was all this tragedy around us. I'm looking forward now that the anniversary's passed to hopefully getting a break and maybe doing a little sailing. But a number of people asked me before Katrina, how is it that you could study this death and destruction, and how could you get into this sort of work? And there were two things. I said, number one is, if I save, or if our research saves the life of just one child, then it's all been worth it. And secondly, my relief valve was to go sailing. So I'd actually wait sometimes in the winter until we got these very strong northerlies coming through, and I'd go out there in the 20-30 knots and sail my boat by myself. But that was my relief, my release, and that's in some ways how I kept my sanity.
During and after the hurricane, you were and continued to be very outspoken in your criticisms of the Army Corps of Engineers and their design for the levees. You've been critical of government response to the hurricane. Have there been consequences for being so outspoken?
Initially, some of my supervisors at the university indicated they would prefer I didn't talk to the media, that I needed to recognize the Katrina story was dead. That created a lot of difficulty, but those issues have now been resolved. And while you know some of upper administration may not agree with some of my opinions, if you will, they recognize that we try to always push the best science forward. And certainly, whether it's the levee studies or anything else, we've always based our statements on science that we can back up.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so very much for this opportunity.
Ivor van Heerden is the deputy director of the LSU Hurricane Center and author of the book The Storm, What Went Wrong and Why During Hurricane Katrina. Coming up, Father Doug Dusson and Sister Kathleen Pittman talk about rebuilding their church in New Orleans and bringing it back to life. This is Fresh Air. With the help of many volunteers and generous people, Father Doug Dusson and Sister Kathleen Pittman have been rebuilding their flooded church and bringing it back to life. But it's a different life than the church had before Katrina, as we're about to hear. St. Gabriel the Archangel Catholic Church is located in the Gentilly section of New Orleans and serves Gentilly and Pontchartrain Park, subdivisions made up primarily of African-American homeowners, many of them elderly. Last Sunday, 300 people showed up for St. Gabriel's Katrina anniversary service. That's about half the number of parishioners the church had before Katrina. But most of the people who did show up came from a distance and have not moved back to the neighborhood, at least not yet. That neighborhood is still pretty devastated. Father Doug is the pastor of St. Gabriel's. Sister Kathleen is the pastoral associate. Father Doug, Sister Kathleen, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, your church is operating again. But what's around it? What does the surrounding neighborhood look like? Have people come back to the community?
We have a number of parishioners who are living in FEMA trailers on their front lawn. We have a number of others who are living in their homes, but mostly on the second floor, because the first floor was, of course, the part that was devastated. But they have electricity and air conditioning, and they're slowly remodeling their first floor. In where my rectory is, where my residence is, the side street, there are five homes that were completely demolished, and they're simply open lots. And it really got to me yesterday. I'd been out of town for a week. Both of us had been on vacation. And when I returned, I noticed my neighbor right across the street, her house was gone, and it was an empty lot. And that kind of did something to me.
Do you feel like it's part of your job to help fight discouragement and despair and give a sense of optimism? And is it hard for you to do that?
Yes, we feel that's our job. And yes, it is hard to do it because both of us are struggling with our own depression over the whole situation. And the fact that where Sister Kathleen lives, that house was destroyed. And the rectory where I lived was also destroyed. And we lost a lot of our possessions. So we have our own struggle going on. And yet we know for so many people, this represents their whole life's work that's been washed away by the flood.
Is that why you're doing this? I mean, I could make the argument that you would both be better off moving someplace else.
You're correct.
Well, depends on what you mean. Yes, physically we would be. But I know for myself, I can only say how I felt at the beginning. Of course, I've had very many moments of second thoughts about it, because it is depressing many times and very difficult to do. But I've felt from the beginning that this is what I had to do, you know, to be there and to do whatever I could to help the parishioners, as long as they wanted it, as long as they felt like they wanted to come back. And we don't always know what that is. We're not always sure we're doing the right thing, and it's often very difficult to do.
When do you become not sure you're doing the right thing? What are those moments of doubt like?
When I drive through the neighborhood and I see so many homes that have been cleaned out and gutted, but there's no other activity going on there. There doesn't seem to be any attempt to rebuild or to come back. So I don't know what those families are thinking. And when I see homes demolished and empty lots, I'm wondering what percentage of our community will return. And are we making a mistake by encouraging people to come back, rebuild their homes, reestablish their lives there? I wonder sometimes.
Let's go back 1 year ago. Where were each of you when the hurricane hit, and what was your day like?
Well, each of us left on Saturday. The hurricane hit on Monday. We left on Saturday because they began the announcements of a mandatory evacuation of Lower Plaquemine and St. Bernard parishes, civil parishes. And then they had the volunteer evacuation of Jefferson Parish and a volunteer evacuation of New Orleans. And I think the handwriting was on the wall. They were going to soon declare it mandatory, and the highways were going to be packed. So we decided to close the church on Saturday afternoon and evacuate. And I went to Baton Rouge, to Saint-Jean-Vianney Parish, and Sister Kathleen also went to Baton Rouge to stay with some fellow religious sisters.
And we encouraged our parishioners to also evacuate. Many of them feel, this is not really going to happen. We don't want to get in that traffic. We're going to come back in 2 or 3 days. We're just going to stay and ride it out. Thank goodness most of them did not decide that, but some did.
How high were the water levels in your neighborhood?
Our two subdivisions are on a decline or a slant toward the lake. And so as you enter the first subdivision of Gentilly Woods, the water would have been 3 feet deep. In the middle of that subdivision, it would be 5 feet. Toward the back of that subdivision, where the parish plant is, it was 8 feet deep. Then as you go back further to Pontchartrain Park, it was up to the roof. It was 11, 12 feet deep. Then, of course, when the land gets to the lake, it comes back up, and those right along the lake or the river, of course, were protected. So we have a sloping land there, and so the water got deeper the deeper you went into each of the subdivisions.
Were any of your parishioners drowned in the hurricane?
Two of our men who refused to leave. Their families begged them to leave, and they refused to. And two of them were drowned. And we had one other parishioner who died of heat exhaustion in one of the nursing homes where she was properly cared for, but they had lost power and lost the air conditioning. And so she died of heat exhaustion, I guess.
When were you able to come back and see your church for the first time after the storm?
It was 5 weeks. The water stayed 3 weeks. The mayor would not let us back in for 5 weeks. So we came back, Sister Kathleen and I and the maintenance man, drove back into the subdivision 5 weeks after the storm. And two of the things we noticed immediately was this thick gray film of mud that covered everything. It was not nice water, you know, that flooded us. It was filthy water. And the second thing we noticed was the silence. There were no children playing, no adults talking. There was not one other car in the neighborhood. We were the only car that drove in at that time. And it was just complete silence. And it just seemed to shout to us, the mud and the silence, there was just no way to bring life back to this community and to this parish. And yet, that was not true.
because everything in your homes and in the church was ruined, you had to throw probably nearly everything you owned, you had to throw away.
Right.
Now, you are both clergy. I mean, you're supposed to transcend attachment to material things. Nevertheless, I'm sure there are things that you were quite attached to and really, really valued for physical or personal or, you know, emotional reasons. What were the hardest things for you to lose in the hurricane?
Well, for me, the hardest thing were my books. I had a library of about 700 or 800 books, and it wasn't so much the loss of the books, but I developed the practice about 10 years ago of putting notes on the back blank pages of the books, referring to different page numbers where I found a particularly interesting insight or fact. And so I must have had about 200 books that had these notes in the back of them. So the pain for me was not just losing the book, but losing all those notes, because I could find whatever I wanted in any of those books very quickly by looking at the notes in the back of the book.
Has there been any advantage in not having that to rely on?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, sometimes when you don't have the things that you're accustomed to having, you have to invent new ways of doing it, and sometimes that results in something good.
I don't think I've found that new way yet.
Right.
I think I might still be looking. I'm mostly mourning what I lost.
I hear you. Do you feel that your faith has been tested in the past year?
Yes, I would say so. There were moments, I guess, for me at first that I felt sometimes, you know, where is God in all this? And that God was sort of not causing any of this. I don't believe that. But God, where are you? You know, are you just watching this on the sidelines? And I think when we started coming back and beginning to get a lot of assistance, as well as meeting again with our parishioners, and to hear them say, people who had been through much more difficult circumstances than I was, we know God is with us. We know, in spite of losing all their possessions, many cases their loved ones, that their faith was still strong. Their faith was still there and a rock. And I tell you, that has been a great blessing to me in strengthening my own faith.
I guess I would say something of the same thing. I guess I've gone through periods where I've gotten very depressed over the whole situation and wondered how in the world this could have possibly happened. The disaster is just so unprecedented. It's so extensive. It's so deep. It's so all-encompassing. It's just hard to imagine anything being so so enormous. And so I guess that's really, I've struggled with that, and I've searched for God in the midst of that. And I think it's true what Kathleen said, that seeing parishioners who have lost more than I have, who maintain such a strong faith, and they will say in the midst of this, well, I know that God is still with me. I lost all these things, but I know God is still with me, and I know God's going to take care of me. And those would be some of the things they would say. And I just found that so encouraging.
In those moments when you have your doubts, do you try to keep those private, or do you share any of those doubts with your parishioners?
I've occasionally shared in my homilies some of my struggles with the parishioners. I've shared it more with friends. But, I guess I've shared it sometimes.
Yes.
And what happens when someone in your parish comes to you and confesses that they feel maybe they're losing their faith because things have gotten so unimaginably bad?
I think that they feel we are part of this. You know, we're not above this. We are not feeling so faith-filled that we don't question God or question the situation. I think they, one of the consolations for them is that we're human just like they are. We've suffered just like they're suffering, and we're all in this together. And I think that is a strengthening thing for them, and I know it is for me in my relationship with them.
My guests are Father Doug Dusson and Sister Kathleen Pittman, the pastor and pastoral associate of St. Gabriel the Archangel Church in New Orleans. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Father Doug Dusson and Sister Kathleen Pittman, the pastor and pastoral associate of St. Gabriel the Archangel Church in New Orleans. We're talking about rebuilding the church and bringing it back to life. Let's end with something that you consider a genuine sign of hope, the kind of thing that you hang on to when you're having your doubts.
I think when we gather for worship on Sunday, and there are 250, 300 people there, many of whom have driven in from maybe an hour, 45 minutes or an hour, to be there. And we sing and we pray, and there's such strong fellowship. The sign of peace, which is part of our liturgy, where people greet one another with the peace of Christ, sometimes goes on for 5 or 10 minutes and expresses the kind of bond that's there. I think when we're gathered together as a community and we're worshiping together, to me, that is a great sign of hope. Because it's sort of saying, number one, nobody is in this alone. We're in this together, and we're here to support each other. And it's also saying we believe that God is with us and that Christ is in our midst, and he will help us find a way to restore our homes and our lives.
When I hear someone who's almost 80 years old, who is a widow and who lived alone before Katrina in a very nice home, when I see she's living in her FEMA trailer and I hear her say, I'm rebuilding. Of course I'm going to rebuild. In fact, I'm not only rebuilding the house the way it was, I wanted to make some changes in it. And so she is expanding her home, and she is after those contractors to be there and to do what they said they were supposed to do. She's a woman, 80 years old, and to have that kind of hope and that kind of faith and that kind of spirit is what gives me hope and faith and spirit.
It sounds like a lot of the people coming to your church now are parishioners, but they're no longer living within the actual parish. They're coming from their new homes. How is that changing the nature of the church to have this almost, you know, like commuting relationship with the parishioners? It's more of like a destination church for a lot of the people.
I think we will know better as time goes on how this will affect us, because up to now we have not had a lot of the different ministry groups or committees meeting. We haven't had the Parish School of Religion, which met every Sunday. So now we're trying to get that started again, and whether or not people will feel like coming back a distance on an evening or on a Saturday, we'll find out, you know, whether that will be the case.
I wonder sometimes if people relocate in the surrounding areas of New Orleans, like some of our parishioners already have, but still come to St. Gabriel for church, whether that's going to get old after a while and whether they're going to stop traveling that distance to come to church. However, we started in February, and this is August, and some of them, they've been doing it for the past 5 or 6 months. And so I think it's a sign of their sense of solidarity with the rest of the congregation.
It sounds like your church is going to keep evolving as post-Katrina New Orleans evolves, and you'll probably have functions within the community you haven't even thought of yet.
I think that's going to be true.
Well, I want to thank you both very much, and I wish you good luck and good health in your rebuilding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Father Doug Dusson is the pastor of St. Gabriel the Archangel Church in the Gentilly section of New Orleans. Sister Kathleen Pittman is the pastoral associate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, are some of the same people who pushed for regime change in Iraq now pushing for regime change in Iran? I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.